Jason Hervey and Dustin Runnels crash their bikes, and Goldberg and Rick Steiner get so lost that there was concern they'd been killed in an accident. And if that weren't bad enough, Buff Bagwell and Ernest Miller got into a real fight backstage after Buff complained about the planned finish of their match. The biggest blow-up, however, came between Hogan and Savage. The two had always had an intense love-hate relationship. When they could make money together, they were in love, and when they couldn't, they weren't. Savage, a well-known paranoid who often carried a gun in his gear bag, went insane, screaming at Hogan that he was holding him down, giving the top spot to Sid, and furthermore, he'd killed off the Humvee angle. While he was at it, he should have yelled about being booked to work a match at Road Wild with Rodman that involved being thrown into a porta-potty. Following the show, Savage walked out and no-showed the next several events. Master P henchman Swole was arrested for speeding and was held when they found out he was late on his child support payments. This despite the fact that WCW was paying him $400,000 per year. With tensions mounting behind the scenes, it was certainly no shock when Bischoff finally snapped and blew a gasket in front of everyone backstage. He yelled at Raven for making disparaging remarks about the company in public, at Conan for saying the word pussy on TV, and Rey Mysterio Jr. for making gay references on TV, as well as Public Enemy and Buff Bagwell for crying about having to lose matches. He told Raven that if he didn't like things, he could leave right now. Amazingly, Raven got up and left. Bischoff, figuring nobody else would have the balls to do the same, made the same offer to the rest of the crew. Conan agreed to leave as well, but Bischoff wouldn't agree to his rather unique terms. Eric went into the room. He said to Raven, "You're always bitching. Here's your contract. I'll give you your release papers if you want them. There's a lawyer right outside." So Raven said, "Give me the release papers. I'll sign them. I'm tired of your bullshit." And he bounced. He said to me, "Conan, you had some foul language on the mic, and I'm not going to put up with it. And I heard you're always bitching." And I said, "How come Rodman can say bad words on the mic?" He said, "I don't expect any less from him." And I said, "If you're going to let Rey Mysterio go, I'll take you up on the offer." He said, "No, I'm not going to let Rey Mysterio go. But if you stay, I'll make your life miserable." Definitely kept his word on that one. Whereas in the old days, Bischoff could comfort himself with the Tuesday morning ratings report, they no longer gave him any relief. Nitro had drawn its lowest number in years, a 2.92. The Kiss concert, as expected, bombed, doing a 2.25 rating. Nothing like spending a half of $1 million to get a number like that. Despite the horrific rating, only weeks later, a plan was put into motion to create a New Year's Eve pay-per-view that would feature a 3-hour wrestling show followed by a full-length Kiss concert at the 70,000-seat Fiesta Bowl in Tempe, Arizona. This would seem to indicate that Eric, under the severe amount of stress, did in fact go totally insane. That would be the only explanation for the next main event feud, which was to feature Sid versus Goldberg. In order to promote the eventual encounter, Sid came out on Nitro one week and claimed that he was 55-0. Never mind that he hadn't had 55 matches on WCW TV since coming back. Or, while we're at it, the fact that he lost several times on TV over the past few weeks alone. By midway through the show, he was at 59-0, despite not having won any matches. Bobby Heenan explained this by saying he'd already beaten up 9 men. Nobody was sure how 55 plus 9 equaled 59. The next week, despite losing at every house show the company ran, he was suddenly up to 68-0. Then he pinned Juventud Guerrera, Lenny Lane, and Lodi. This made him 70-0. Again, do not ask how 68 plus 3 equals 70. 3 days later, on Thunder, Sid said he couldn't wait to get 6 more wins so he could break Goldberg's 176-0 streak. Yeah. Once he did this, Sid inexplicably added he was going to, quote, shake all over. In September, Sid, at 76-0, lost to Saturn via DQ when Rick Steiner ran in. On Nitro the following Monday, however, he was billed as 77-0. So yes, losses were now counting as wins in this streak. If Sid shaking all over wasn't enough to entice viewers to continue watching, Barbarian on this same program threatened Harlem Heat by loudly proclaiming in an interview with Gene Okerlin, "How you say? We will eat you lunch." Nobody ever figured out what he meant. Some theorize that Barbarian wanted it known that when Harlem Heat showed up at the building the following week, he was going to eat their lunch. Shockingly, the Sid winning streak didn't stop the downward spiral. The following week, Raw was moved to 11 o'clock p.m. due to the U.S. Open tennis tournament, which meant Nitro had all 3 hours unopposed. They responded by putting on a horrendous show that actually seemed designed to fail. Final tally? Nitro, unopposed, did a 4.0 rating, losing to the 11 o'clock p.m. Raw, which did a 4.16. It got even worse, as that Thursday, the WWF debuted their SmackDown show opposite Thunder and destroyed WCW once again in the ratings, 4.16 to 1.94. And the hits just kept on coming. September 6 was the special 4th anniversary Nitro show from the 16,000-seat Miami Arena. They drew 3,818 paid. Not only that, Raw had been preempted for tennis again, and sure enough, they still won 4.38 to 4.12. The Nitro show, for the second straight unopposed week, was hideous. There was one good thing on the show. They began auditions to find a new Nitro girl, and after 8 weeks, they settled upon a young Ravens cheerleader named Stacy Keibler. Not only would she go on to become one of the biggest female wrestling stars in history, she would also spend a few years dating George Clooney. Finally, it was too much for Turner Brass to take. And so Eric Bischoff, the man who led WCW to its most profitable 2-year period ever, was, quote, reassigned on September 9. Bischoff would later claim that this basically meant he was sent home to Colorado, where he hunted and fished for many months while still collecting huge paychecks. There really was no other decision the Turner Brass could have made, as under Bischoff's watch, WCW had not only grown to never-before-seen heights, but was also now tanking at mind-boggling speed. Turner was so upset with Bischoff that he was banned from all WCW events as well as from the office. On top of this, Turner demanded that no references to Bischoff be made and that no footage of him be used in any future video packages. To the company, the man who once turned it all around had just suddenly ceased to exist. A strange little man by the name of Bill Bush, who'd started at Turner almost a decade earlier as an accountant, was put in charge as executive vice president. Because he knew virtually nothing about wrestling, TV producer Craig Leathers was put in charge of creative. And who was working under him, doing all the real grunt work and putting the shows together? None other than the three men who had helped get WCW into this mess in the first place. Dusty Rhodes, Kevin Nash, and Kevin Sullivan. Bush, along with Dr. Harvey Schiller, the Turner representative in charge of overseeing WCW, met with the wrestlers and announced that some things were going to change. The New Year's Eve pay-per-view idea with Kiss was canned. A ridiculous contest to give away $1 million to a lucky fan rather than, say, an inebriated Dennis Rodman, was canceled. The annual Road Wild pay-per-view from Sturgis, now an annual money loser at a time when money could not afford to be lost, was canceled. And a proposed Nitro cartoon. Seriously. And by a cartoon, we mean an animated children's program, not just another episode of the show, was scrapped. Further tragedy struck on September 8, when referee Brian Curtis Hildebrand passed away following a long battle with stomach cancer. Only 37, he was such a courageous and lovable person that condolences were sent out on Monday night, not only on Nitro, but on Raw as well, where he never worked. Like Owen Hart's death, this was particularly tragic, as he left his friends and family behind through no fault of his own. The first post-Bischoff pay-per-view was Fall Brawl. If anyone needed evidence of how screwed up WCW at this point, consider the fact that they'd done such a poor job of planning that there wasn't any card at all a week before the show aired. Even the cable companies finally lost it, and the following ad appeared in newspapers nationwide. "We're the advertising agency, and they won't even tell us who's going to be there. For God's sake, don't miss it." Below that, it read, quote, "Sunday, September 12. Insert time here." When the buy rate numbers came out, WCW's incompetence was illustrated quite painfully. The show did an 0.30, lower than any number the WWF or WCW had ever done. The show in the 11,000-seat Lawrence Joel Coliseum in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, drew 3,347 paid, the result of years of killing Ric Flair and the Horsemen over and over and over and over again in the Carolinas. There was no Flair on the card, and in fact, there had been no Flair on TV in months since he'd had yet another falling out with Bischoff, and neither side could agree on terms to return. Perhaps you're thinking that with Erica gone, Flair could come back. Well, you're right, and he returned on Nitro the next evening. However, he was actually in Winston-Salem for the pay-per-view, and WCW, for their usual stupidity, didn't use him on the show at all. The main event saw Sting beat Hulk Hogan to win the WCW title. For weeks, the idea had been batted back and forth to turn either Hogan or Sting heel. Hogan didn't want to do it, feeling it was too early since he just turned babyface months earlier. So, Sting got the gig, and it was his first run as a heel in over a decade. The bad news was that the fans hated Hogan, so when Sting hit him with a baseball bat and got the win, they all cheered. The biggest event on Nitro the following night was arguably Kidman beating Psicosis in a very good mask versus hair match. Bischoff had been wanting to take Psicosis' mask for a long time. You know, because masked guys aren't marketable. And even though he was done with the company, they went through with the angle anyway. Sid, by the way, was magically at 86-0 this evening, and somehow over the next 3 days, he won 13 matches, going in a thunder at 99-0. The next week, he was at 120-0, and since he never won at the house shows, not that there were 21 during the week anyway, all that could be theorized was that one loss was now counting as 5 to 10 wins. And then, on October 3rd, it happened. The beginning of the end. Well, the latest beginning of the end. That was the day Vince Russo, after a lengthy meeting with Bill Bush, signed his WCW contract. Russo was a longtime wrestling fan and video store owner who broke into the business in the early 1990s by sponsoring a wrestling radio show in New York. Eventually, the WWF hired him, more to shut him up than anything else. He was put to work as an editor for the WWF magazine, and after he wrote a few fantasy storylines that the company liked, they put him in charge of the division. Eventually, he worked his way up to being a television writer, and he had significant input into the late 90s product that laid waste to Nitro week after week. Russo was good. Not at writing wrestling TV, mind you, but at spinning folks into believing that he and his buddy Ed Ferrara, who'd also jumped ship with him, were the sole reason behind the WWF's success. In hindsight, it's clear that Russo was a very creative man. However, and many in the WWF expressed this belief long before he ever started working for WCW, his creative had to be harnessed by an editor, and in the WWF, that editor was the same guy who'd had final say since day one, Vince McMahon. In WCW, he had no editor, and the results spoke for themselves. Despite everything he might ever say to the contrary, the history of his regime follows in hard numbers and will hopefully settle a few arguments once and for all. While Russo was in fact deemed WCW's possible savior, interestingly enough, others were also courted. One such person was longtime Southern wrestling promoter Jerry Jarrett. Jarrett, who promoted wrestling in Tennessee and the surrounding states, certainly made sense as someone WCW would make a play to bring into a position of power. His history included a stint in Memphis, where his show wasn't only the biggest pro wrestling event on television, it was the biggest show in all of television in that market. The 30-plus years he had in promoting wrestling was also a huge plus in his favor. So, why didn't it happen? For the very simple reason that Jarrett saw it as a no-win situation. I refused the job at WCW on 5 occasions because I would not allow myself to be in a situation that was sure to fail. And what did Jarrett think of the Russo-produced WCW? A horrible hodgepodge. The shows had no form, and I could not follow anything as far as storylines. It was like reading a book by someone on LSD. There was no continuity. One can make plenty of excuses about talent cooperation or corporate interference, but there was no excuse for ignoring the basic rules of creative writing, whether it's a novel, a short story, or a wrestling program. Yep, sounds like you didn't like it. Another Russo detractor would be Jim Cornette. I had to spend 11 months in the same room with Vince Russo and Vince McMahon. That's where I really got to hate life in general. They put Bruce Prichard in the office and put Russo on the writing team. At first, it was sort of like the Donald Pleasance line in the original Halloween. For the first 6 years, I tried to reach him, and then I spent the next 8 trying to make sure that he would never escape being locked up. Because what I saw behind those eyes was pure and simple evil. For the first few months, I thought, okay, he's a nice, energetic guy who doesn't know anything about wrestling. We're going to try to teach him. Then I figured out he didn't want to learn because he thought he knew what the fuck he was doing and that we were all crazy and that he wasn't ever going to learn anything about wrestling and didn't want to. Then I made it my life's mission to somehow keep everything that he did from actually seeing the light of day to the detriment of the wrestling business. Finally, it got to the point where all we did was argue with each other. But Russo's problem, besides the fact that he is from New York and he's the worst stereotype of just an obnoxious Yankee, is that he was not a wrestling fan. He watched wrestling and liked angles and liked gimmicks. He wasn't enough of a wrestling fan to watch and understand that all those things he saw as a child, like Piper hitting Jimmy Snuka with a coconut or whatever, those things happen every few months, and then you followed up on them so they made sense when you did them, because you told the story leading up to them, explaining why these people would do these things. All Russo would remember, because he had the attention span of a fucking junkie with a clicker on a morphine trip, were the actual incidents themselves. So he wanted to write a 2-hour television show full of people hitting people over the head with coconuts, and he fucking loved the Jerry Springer show, and he thought that the wrestling fan's IQ was out of a flea, and their attention span was like his, and all they wanted to see was mayhem and carnage. He didn't believe in baby faces and heels, because there is no such thing as good people and bad people, everybody knows that. Fucking idiot. So he put matches together where people didn't know who to cheer for. They didn't know whose side who was on. That was the problem. Russo remembered all the highlights in his little pea brain that he had seen growing up, but he didn't understand how they were done, why they were done, how they were led up to, and how they were followed up on. Not a fan, obviously. The October 4th Nitro was broadcast from the Kemper Arena in Kansas City, where Owen Hart had passed away several months earlier. The storylines were no better than usual, but this can be blamed on the old regime, as Russo's first day was scheduled to be Halloween Havoc later that month. Kevin Nash, who had retired forever months earlier, returned on this show along with Scott Hall, who took his stint in rehab so seriously that he acted drunk during his promo. Hall actually said that Nash was working a fake retirement, and that when wrestling got fun again, he'd return. When Gene Okerlund tried to say it was fun, Hall said Okerlund must not have been in the dressing room lately. There was one very bright spot on the show. Several months earlier, Bret had asked if he could do an Owen Hart tribute match with Benoit on the show. The company agreed, although they nixed his request to let Benoit win, feeling it would dampen the spirits of the crowd. The match was excellent and went 27 minutes and 33 seconds, making it by far the longest in-ring TV encounter of the year. Although fans had been groomed to only accept short, Crash TV-style matches, they responded very well to this and gave both guys a standing ovation afterwards. Prior to his first Nitro, Russo appeared on the Wrestling Observer Live radio show to promote himself. He said that, years back, when WCW started Thunder, everyone in the WWF had rejoiced because they knew it would lead the company to sink at a rapid rate due to overexposure. However, they clearly didn't learn a lesson from that because they had just recently started their own second two-hour show, SmackDown. He said he'd been working ungodly hours and was rapidly burning out. So he went to McMahon and asked for a raise, a 15-month contract, to give him a little job security and the freedom to move out of Stamford, Connecticut. He'd always hated Stamford, but because the WWF offices were located there, he was stuck. McMahon shot him down. Russo said this was ridiculous, because in the real TV business, if you were writing one show and were suddenly asked to write another, you wouldn't be asked to do it for free. He was especially irate when, after saying he never had time to see his three children, Vince told him that he made enough money to hire a nanny. Almost nothing of value happened on Nitro over the next few weeks, since they were all lame duck shows written by a regime that was simply holding down the fort until Russo took over. The most notable thing was that Hogan was absent, supposedly teasing another retirement, after getting word that Russo thought he needed to be phased out. In reality, he was in cahoots with Russo for another storyline. A strong Goldberg push also began. Management had decreed several weeks earlier that Goldberg should be the top guy in the company, and Russo believed that he could be the biggest thing in wrestling, but he'd just never been pushed properly. Although Russo wanted to push Goldberg, he made it clear that there were others he wasn't interested in doing anything with. In an online interview with Ben Miller of the website WrestleLine.com, he made the following statement, which he'd live to regret. I'm going to tell you something right now that you will absolutely not agree with, but I've been a wrestling fan my whole life, and I will live and die by this. It's hard enough, believe me, I write this shit. It is hard enough to get somebody over. You will never, ever, 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 ever see the Japanese wrestlers or the Mexican wrestlers over in American mainstream wrestling. And the simple reason for that is, even myself, I'm an American. And I don't want to sound like a bigot or a racist or anything like that, but I'm an American. If I'm watching wrestling here in America, I don't give a shit about a Japanese guy. I don't give a shit about a Mexican guy. I'm from America, and that's what I want to see. Russo and Ferrara ended up starting early on October 18th in Philadelphia. It was quite the Nitro, a three-hour car crash that featured two or three happenings at each of the 16 quarters scripted. To say that this was overkill would be putting it lightly, as by the end of the third hour, the live crowd was completely burned out, sitting in their chairs like zombies staring at the ring. Russo had a plan to take care of that, however. No, it was not to book less stuff, but to eliminate the third hour of Nitro at the beginning of 2000. It was a completely different show. Backstage, everyone was handed very detailed scripts. Yet as detailed as they were, some still couldn't figure out whether they were supposed to be good guys or bad guys. The majority of this was tied to the fact that Russo didn't believe in the traditional good guys versus bad guys thing. He felt that every character should be a mix of both, a shade of gray, so to speak. He also apparently believed that every fan scoured the internet for insider wrestling news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Because he praised Bagwell in one radio interview, he booked a segment in which Bagwell came out saying that, quote, everyone knew he was the chosen one according to the new writers. Of course, Not everybody knew that. Worse, he then had a, quote, fake match with Laparca, yes, a fake match, and, quote, took a dive. Afterwards, Bagwell jumped up like nothing had happened, grabbed the mic, and proclaimed, "Hey, Russo, did I do a good job for you?" Of course, doing a job means losing a match in wrestling. The point of these angles was never explained. After all, 95% of the fans weren't online looking for wrestling news all day, so they had no idea what Bagwell was talking about. And the 5% who were aware didn't buy it anyway, so there was no logical reason for it. The longest match on the program went 9 minutes. Actually, a lot longer than many people expected. Also, for historical purposes, it should be noted that the first match of the Russo era went to a no contest when a third man just sauntered into the ring. The match was Juventud Guerrera versus Evan Courageous, and the third man was Bret Hart. The best part of this was that nobody bothered to clue Hoovy and Evan in, so they had no idea what was happening and just stood there looking totally confused. On the bright side, the show did a much better rating than the week before, jumping 0.7 to a 3.30. Of course, it still lost to Raw's 5.39, but things were much closer for once. Many fans and wrestlers felt this was proof that Russo's formula was the way to go. Others noted, correctly, that the 2.61 rating from the week before had been for a lame duck Nash presentation that had seemed to stretch about 6 minutes worth of thought into a 3-hour broadcast. A review of the monthly averages proved there hadn't been a major jump, which media reports at the time pegged anywhere between 25 and 35%. July averaged a 3.37. August averaged a 3.27. September averaged a 3.38. And Russo and Ferrara's first three shows averaged a 3.33. Despite the hype, not much had changed. One of Russo's first orders of business was to poach Jeff Jarrett, the WWF's Intercontinental Champion, from the competition. Jarrett had been a colorless heel for much of his WWF tenure and had just started to get over doing an angle in which he beat women. Everything was building towards a pay-per-view match where he would defend his belt against the top women's wrestler in the company, Chyna, a huge female bodybuilder, with an alleged 350-pound bench press. But for once, it was the WWF who had the problem. The pay-per-view was on a Sunday, and Jarrett's $350,000 contract expired the night before. Vince McMahon was in a quandary. His Intercontinental Champion suddenly didn't have any contractual obligation to return and could show up on Nitro the day after the pay-per-view. Because the ball was in Jarrett's court, the WWF ended up paying him $150,000 to come back and wrestle the one match, losing his belt to Chyna clean in the middle of the ring. Jarrett was especially pleased because earlier in the year, despite the booming business, he'd been forced to take a $100,000 pay cut. Incidentally, because he held the company up for money, and given the circumstances of them not taking the title off of him prior to his contract expiring, he had every right to do so. Jarrett was permanently banned by McMahon from ever returning to his company. In the end, it was the pro wrestling butterfly effect. Because the pay-per-view happened to fall one day after his contract expired, he used that to his advantage, held the company up for money, and was subsequently banned from ever returning. So, when WCW died, he had no option but to try to put together a new promotion to headline in, the eventual TNA Impact Wrestling. Had his contract come due one single day later, perhaps the future Spike TV wrestling franchise would never have existed. The October 14 Thunder was one for the ages. Since it was the last under the Nash era, he basically turned it into one giant inside joke. He sat in on commentary and did nothing but make shoot comments all night, the vast majority of which were not only too inside for 99% of the audience, but also not funny at all. His very first statement was that everyone had accused him of being a horrible booker, but he had outsmarted them all by booking himself in the greatest angle ever, his own retirement. If only that were true. Halloween Havoc, Russo and Ferrara's first WCW pay-per-view, took place on October 24th at the MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas, before 8,464 fans. It definitely illustrated a new direction, although it was too early to determine whether or not it would pay off. It was an angle-laden show, and the wrestling itself was largely bad. Some of it just made no sense whatsoever. For example, Goldberg won the WCW US title from Sid on a blood stoppage, but then, in the very next match, Flair bled a total gusher, and the match wasn't stopped. Bret Hart, who was being groomed for the WCW title, lost to Lex Luger. And then there was Hogan versus Sting, which never took place. The idea Russo wanted to get across was that he told Hogan to lose the match, and Hogan didn't want to. So Hogan went out in street clothes, whispered something to Sting, then lay down so Sting could pin him and win the WCW title. Nobody watching had any idea what in the hell was going on. The cameras quickly cut away, and the announcers never bothered to try to explain it. They attempted to explain what was happening in the main event, saying Goldberg versus new WCW champion Sting was non-title. A few minutes later, Goldberg pinned him and was handed the WCW title. The show ended with everyone in a state of utter confusion. Lesson not learned. The insane pace of WCW shows from this era was truly a precursor to what Russo was going to bring to his future employer, TNA. If anything, the 2006 to 2010 Impact shows made Nitro look like the slowest moving foreign film your girlfriend ever dragged you to see. Part of this may have had to do with Impact being taped in advance, and Russo believing that he could cram more into a two-hour show than the constraints of time allowed. Major championships would be won, but there was no time for celebration. Instead, viewers needed to be immediately sent backstage where women were complaining about their makeup. Absolutely nothing was given time to sink in, and therefore, nothing could be taken as an important event. Just how major of an issue was this? The most recognizable catchphrase at the time wasn't that of any TNA wrestler, but of announcer Mike Tenay. His verbiage? To the back! The show was also the last decent buy rate the company would ever do. Regardless of what anyone might say about the quality of the show or the style of Russo's writing, the fact is that this pay-per-view did an 0.52 buy rate. Whether it was because they toned down the in-ring product in order to present significantly more angles, or ran angles targeted toward a great minority of viewers, the fact is that fans were turned off by the idea of paying to see World Championship Wrestling on pay-per-view. Within 8 months, things would get so bad that the company would loudly celebrate buy rates in the 0.19 range. Going into the October 25th Nitro, Goldberg was the WCW World and U.S. Champion. However, J.J. Dillon explained that Sting versus Goldberg from the night before was not a sanctioned match, and therefore, the belt had been held up. A 32-man tournament was set up, with the final two men squaring off at the next pay-per-view to determine a new WCW champion. The first tourney match took place in the Nitro main event. Bret, on a losing streak, beat Goldberg not only to advance, but also to win his U.S. title. Also on the show, Nash, who had retired forever in August, returned to the ring. What was the big angle to bring him back, you ask? He was told he had a match. That's it. Prior to the show, there was another major shakedown, with Bush going crazy about how upset Turner's standards and practices had been lately. Their biggest complaint was Flair's juice job on the pay-per-view, which, as you'll recall, had also been a big deal internally because he bled more in this match than the guy did in the match that got stopped because of blood. It was said in no uncertain terms that there would be no more swearing, no more bleeding, no more ref bumps, and no more hitting women without 100% authorization given. Bush even went as far as to say that if things didn't change, Turner would consider shutting down the company outright. Later, despite the fact that these decrees should have helped make the product better, fans were sick of constant ref bumps, and it wasn't like swearing and beating up women was going to turn the company around. Russo blamed these limitations for the company failing under his leadership. Russo's insanity took center stage on the October 28th Thunder. They did a skit backstage in which Kidman came across Scotty Riggs and Buff Bagwell having a conversation. Here, verbatim, is their conversation. Bagwell said, "You're pinning me? 1, 2, 3? Scotty Riggs said, "That's the finish they gave me." Yes, they were in the midst of planning out their fake wrestling match. It gets better. During the match, Bagwell rolled him up with a small package and, quote, refused to let him go. The ref counted 2, paused, then grudgingly counted 3. Bagwell ran off laughing, having supposedly put one over on those evil writers from up north. Again, insider fans considered it a stupid fake angle, and casual fans had no idea what was happening, so there was ultimately no reason for doing it. But Russo trudged on. What was also strange was that the November 1 Nitro, now operating under the new decrees to the point that they were bleeping out the word screw, was widely regarded both internally and by fans at home as a really good show. Of course, really good show meant a really good show for Nitro, not necessarily a really good show by any other standards. There were production snafus galore, including cameramen giving post-angle cues before they'd cut away, wrestlers blatantly breaking character because they thought the cameras were off, and just plain downright horrible acting. They also continued the world title tournament, which was a booking disaster. Most of the matches lasted about a minute, death in any tournament that you're trying to make seem important. Plus, weird things were happening, like guys advancing to the second round despite never actually having won a match in the first round. Nitro also introduced a new character, one that would soon be the spotlight of every show. Russo's voice. That's right. He would sit behind a wall, so all you could see was an arm, and he'd talk to guys like Dr. Claw from the old Inspector Gadget cartoons. On WCW Live later that week, he vowed that his face would never be seen on television. Never, he reiterated. In a strange turn of events, Dr. Harvey Schiller, the man who made the move to can Bischoff, suddenly left Turner to take a job with George Steinbrenner. He was replaced by Brad Siegel, whose name you'll hear quite a bit more in the upcoming pages. The November 8th Nitro was the exact opposite of the show the week before. The program was horrible on countless levels. Instead of 3 things happening in each of the 16 quarters, about 10 things happened in each, and none of it made any sense at all. Sid opened the show with a weird promo, in which he informed everyone that he was not as stupid as he looked. Medusa, a woman booked into a tournament for the men's heavyweight championship, who had already been eliminated, was reinserted into the brackets, and then eliminated again. Probably the highlight of the booking insanity was Brian Knobbs beating Bam Bam Bigelow via count out in a Falls Count Anywhere match. Yes, the Falls could count anywhere, even presumably in another universe, but somehow Bam Bam Bigelow got counted out. He was fighting with Knobbs backstage, then ran off to help Kimberly. The referee apparently decided that if Bigelow wasn't there, he wasn't anywhere, so he counted to 10, and when Bigelow didn't return, he called for the bell. The sad thing is that the show actually made more sense than the one the following week, which was notable for a skit in which Ferrara went out in front of the live audience and mocked WWF announcer Jim Ross, who had been suffering from Bell's palsy for years. He then introduced his new sidekick, Steve Williams, a longtime friend of the real-life Ross. William's task was to run in during a piñata on a pole match with the Mexican wrestlers and beat them all up. He beat them up all right and put El Dandy, Juventud Guerrera, and Psicosis in the hospital for real. For whatever reason, those guys, Russo and Ferrara, were total marks for a pole match, Eddie Guerrero wrote in his autobiography. They'd put anything on a pole. Piñatas, brass knuckles, a crowbar, a leather jacket, Buff Bagwell's mother. My personal pole match fiasco had the Revolution locking Billy Kidman's girlfriend, Tori Wilson, in a shark cage. Russo and Ferrara had no idea how to save WCW. The backstage politics might have improved under their reign, but the product continued to suck. Sid, whose interviews were quickly becoming a weekly highlight of the show, said he was twice the man Kevin Nash was, and added, "I have half the brain you have." Main event was Sid versus Nash in a no-DQ match that ended in a DQ. All of this is true. The show did a 3.07, well below average. Russo, still eyeing that lone 2.61 the Nash show had drawn, continued to insist that things were turning around, thanks to him. It should be noted that Raw did a 6.20. Why is this important? Well, besides claiming that he turned WCW's numbers around, Russo also claimed for years that when he left the WWF, things started to rapidly go downhill. In reality, everything across the board, from ratings to buy rates to merchandise figures, increased, in some cases dramatically, and this was during a time when three of the company's biggest stars, Undertaker, Austin, and McMahon, had been off television for months. And so Russo continued with his wacky skits and matches. Wrestlers retired, forever, and then unretired days later. Matches ended when wrestlers, who weren't in the original match, pinned other wrestlers who also weren't in the match. Sid's promos somehow began to make even less sense. Russo would later tell the New York Times, "There is one word that we start and end every conversation with. Logic. Once you lose the logic of the situation, then you lose the realism and you lose the audience." Indeed. The WCW Mayhem pay-per-view, which replaced the annual debacle known as World War III, drew 12,119 paid, 313,847 U.S. at the gate, for the finals of the disaster known as the WCW World Title Tournament. Because Russo's emphasis was on wacky angles instead of in-ring work, four of the matches, Evan Courageous versus Disco Inferno, Meng versus Lex Luger, Vampiro versus Berlin, and David Flair versus Kimberly, yes, Kimberly, were in the infamous negative star range, and three, Bagwell versus Hennig, Scott Hall versus Booker T, and Goldberg versus Sid, were only slightly better. The crowd in Toronto turned on the show big time, and some of the seemingly most popular babyfaces, including Goldberg, were booed vociferously. Although it made sense with Goldberg, since the last time he was in the area, he did the steel plate under the jersey angle with the super popular Hart. The fans left happy, at least, as Hart beat Benoit in a good match to win the tournament and the title. Unfortunately, because the tournament had been booked so poorly, and because the title had been devalued so greatly over the past year, he actually won a belt nobody cared about. Oh, and if you're wondering why Kimberly Page, who created the Nitro Girls, was now wrestling instead of, well, dancing, this would be the reason why. Russo killed it. When he showed up there, he didn't want to have the Nitro Girls anymore. From a marketing standpoint, we were a jewel, selling calendars and magazines and such. But he wanted to go in a different direction. He said, "If the girls are going to stick around, they're going to have to get in the ring." By that point, I was over it. And speaking of titles, Psicosis was suddenly the Cruiserweight champion. Thankfully, WCW.com explained what happened. Quote, "Psicosis was awarded the belt after the West Hollywood Blondes angle was dropped." Nitro the following night, which was better than usual, did a 3.41 to Raw's 5.51. There was one big victory, however. The main events going head-to-head were Triple H versus the Acolytes for Raw, and Goldberg and Sid versus Hall and Nash for Nitro. The Raw match dropped from a 5.23 to a 4.73, while the Nitro rating jumped from a 3.44 to a 3.99, meaning many fans gave up on the Raw main event to watch Nitros. Let's briefly backtrack to that week's Nitro and look at some of the fun, logical things that occurred during the 3-hour period. Sid turned babyface and was immediately pinned in the main event. Evan Courageous, who had just won the Cruiserweight belt from Disco Inferno the night before, got squashed by Saturn for no discernible reason in 1 minute. Two Nitro girls had a horrific match and didn't even show any skin. Dean Malenko beat Chris Benoit in a Capture the Flag match by grabbing the Canadian flag, even though Tony Schiavone had stated that the only way to win was to grab your own flag. And Kurt Hennig, who had retired the night before to a standing ovation, pinned Buff Bagwell in a match that he wasn't even in. It was Bagwell versus Booker T. Don't ask. Or how about the week after, November 29th? Jushin Liger, the prestigious IWGP Junior Heavyweight Champion for New Japan Pro Wrestling, identified by Russo as Jushin Thunder Liger, the IWGP Light Heavyweight Champion, lost the belt to Juventud Guerrera, the Mexican, when Juvi hit him with a tequila bottle. Jim Duggan beat up four men with a foam rubber 2x4. Jerry Only of the band The Misfits, who were being paid over $4,000 per appearance, despite not being wrestlers, beat Steve, Dr. Death Williams, in a cage match. Scott Hall took a bump into the cage and sliced at his forehead right in front of the TV cameras, but it turned out to be a rib because he wasn't holding a razor and didn't bleed. Hennig officially unretired, then wrestled a scary Amazon female named Midnight. The Nitro girls had a food fight. Hall locked Sid in a room with a door that had no hinges, so Sid easily broke free. And Ronda Singh and Liz had a mud match where the finish saw Roddy Piper, who was not in the match, pin Ron Harris, who was also not in the match. On Thunder, which somehow still existed at this point, Russo made the move to add a new man to the color commentary position. Juventud Guerrera, who spoke almost no English. You see, Russo thought it was funny to hear this guy going on and on for 2 hours in broken English, making insider comments such as how Lex Luger was on, quote, the juice, slang for steroids, although Tony Schiavone tried to claim Juvi was talking about apple or orange juice. This was funny for a few shows, but quickly overstayed its welcome, which of course meant Russo had to keep it going much, much longer. This all led to the December 16th show, quite possibly the worst Thunder of all time. It opened with Sid cutting his usual nonsensical promo in which he identified Nash and Hall as, quote, two shoes. He and Benoit were told they'd have a one-on-one match with each other later, and if they didn't, they'd be suspended for 6 months. They never had the match, and they never got suspended. Juvi was back doing commentary and put over the Prince Iaukea versus Courageous bout as the jabroni match of the week. David Flair somehow managed to go to a no contest with Norman Smiley in a hardcore match. This caused Juvi to state, in a truly great line, "Now, tell me please the point of this match." Jeff Jarrett, perhaps wanting to get a push like Sid, attempted to outdo him in a promo by telling Dustin Rhodes, whom he called a horn yacker, that he could bring anything he wanted to their upcoming bunkhouse match, including a bay of hail or a hail of bay. The main event just kind of ended after referee Roddy Piper was knocked out, which meant, in a 2-hour show, not one single match had a clean finish. What did all of this horrible booking do to the company? Consider this. From January to March of 1999, average house show attendance was 8,000 per show. From April to June, that dropped to 6,000. July through September, 4,500. And October to the end of the year, 4,200. Youch. Kevin Sullivan told me it was the Titanic, and Bobby Heenan told me it was the Hindenburg, so get your check on the 15th and the 30th of the month while it lasted, Whipwreck said. But fear not! Russo had a plan. For weeks there had been talk that he was gearing up for his big angle, the storyline that was going to turn the company around once again. It was originally set to peak at Mayhem, but then was pushed back to their biggest show of the year, Starrcade. Fans and wrestlers wondered what it could be. Did a major name jump ship from Raw? Had Russo, the insane genius, come up with an idea that nobody in wrestling had ever thought of before? What was it? It was Montreal. Yes. Again. Bret Hart beat Goldberg to retain the WCW title after Roddy Piper, playing the role of Earl Hebner, came out and rang the fucking bell when Goldberg was locked in the sharpshooter. It was quite something to see Bret playing the role of Shawn Michaels. Fans had no idea how to react to this except with hatred. It was a hell of a way to cap off a show featuring 13 mostly bad matches. Amazingly, things were about to get worse. Nitro the next night featured Goldberg damn near ending his career as the result of a stunt gone wrong. The beginning of his match against Hart was to see Hall and Nash tease hitting Bret with a baseball bat, but then hitting Goldberg instead to lead to the pin. Roddy Piper would then run down and cover Goldberg's body to save him from further damage. Piper missed his cue, so he covered Goldberg immediately after Hall and Nash hit him with the bat. This caused a problem, seeing as to how Bret hadn't pinned him yet. So Bret tried to pull Piper off, but since Piper had been instructed to stay on top of him at all costs, he refused to move. So finally the ref just counted three with Roddy on top, then announced that Bret somehow was the winner. Afterwards, Bret, Hall, and Nash reformed the NWO for the 87th time. As the show was about to end, Goldberg stormed to the back, vowing to kill every member of the new NWO. He broke many things. One of the things he decided to break was the window of a white limo that supposedly contained the evil scriptwriter, Vince Russo. Russo, of course, was responsible for him not beating Bret at Starrcade, and also for causing him to lose to Roddy Piper moments earlier. The original idea was for Goldberg to break the window with a sledgehammer. It was decided that this would not look cool enough. Instead, he was going to break through the window with his bare fist, aided by a concealed piece of pipe. Unfortunately, he dropped the pipe, and since he wasn't done breaking things, he tried to bust through a window with his bare elbow. A shard of broken glass ripped through his flesh, and he began to bleed profusely. The cameras quickly cut away, and guys rushed in with towels, several of which were soon completely drenched with blood. Goldberg was rushed to the hospital to undergo plastic surgery. Later he was told that he'd lost 31.5 liters of blood, and that he'd come within 1 centimeter of losing his arm. This dangerous stunt meant zero for ratings, though, as the show ended up doing a 3.20 to Raw's 5.83. Russo, irate at the negative internet response to the two shows, went ballistic on WCW Live, saying none of this was his fault, and the reason ratings hadn't turned around was because standards and practices had banned, among other things, angles like Roddy Piper calling Ronda Singh fat, and Ed Ferrara mocking Ross's Bell's Palsy. Nobody was sure how a fat Ronda Singh or a poor Jim Ross impersonation was going to turn around the company, but Russo was indignant. He said Turner could either have a squeaky clean show or ratings, not both. Again, nobody was able to explain why not. As revenge, he said, he was going to repackage Lenny and Lodi as a dork tag team called Standards and Practices. That would show them. It sure would. The last Nitro of 1999 was quite fitting, as the man who told the New York Times that he began and ended every conversation with the word logic wrote an angle in which Sid was locked in a car, which Bret then ran over with a monster truck. Not only did Sid survive, he was back the following week. The show did a miserable 2.86 to Raw's 5.85. Russo insisted that everyone relax. The turnaround, he said, would take at least 6 months. Little did Russo know that he himself didn't have 6 months left. They always say, you can't kill this business, you can only bruise it. But what happened with WCW is living proof that you can kill this business when the people running it know nothing about it. Bobby Heenan, WCW announcer from 1994 to 2000. Chapter 6, 2000. Everything falls apart. WCW entered 2000 in poor shape. The promotion wasn't dead yet, but it was certainly very ill. As mentioned in the previous chapter, when all the numbers came in for 1999, the company was found to have lost $15 million. The reasons for that were many, although some simplistically tried to pin the blame on, quote, guaranteed contracts. Many wrestlers were guaranteed huge money, they argued, and this created a tendency to not work as hard. As a result, the product suffered. It's time to debunk that theory once and for all. The real reason WCW lost so much money had nothing to do with guaranteed deals. In 1996 and 1997, wrestlers with guaranteed deals were making tons of money, and because the company itself was making bank, these wrestlers were actually underpaid. There were a few complaints about guys being lazy, but those who were would have been lazy no matter what kind of contract they had. The problem wasn't the guaranteed contracts. It was that the people in charge failed to elevate or create new main eventers when they had the perfect opportunities to do so. And when business started to fail, all of a sudden those same guys who were underpaid in 1997 were now overpaid. Things got worse in 1999 because so much money was spent on stupid things like destroying Humvees and paying rock bands hundreds of thousands of dollars to do 2.13 quarters. In the past, this could easily have been covered, but because the buy rates were tanking, there wasn't enough revenue to make up for those expenses. The good news seemed to be that under the soon-to-be AOL Time Warner corporate umbrella, $15 million was merely a drop in the bucket. Plus, it wasn't like there was no hope whatsoever for the company. Even in early 2000, it appeared that one good idea could potentially turn everything around. Sadly, the mistakes from 1999 were not only repeated in 2000, but even dumber errors were made. As buy rates continued to sink, the company found itself buried deeper and deeper in debt. By early 2001, 1999 looked like the cheery days of yesteryear. Going into 2000, however, Vince Russo was confident. The company was rolling into the new century, primed for some major ratings changes. Interestingly, the changes had nothing to do with his booking savvy, or lack thereof. In early January, Nitro moved from 3 hours to 2. There were a couple of reasons for this. The first was that 3 hours was just too damn long to run a wrestling show, both for the writers and for the fans, especially a show that had become so ponderous as Nitro had. The second was that by cutting out the opposed third hour, the composite 2 hour rating would pretty much automatically jump by several tenths of a point. Lesson not learned. In 2012, WWE was commissioned by the USA Network to change Raw from a 2 hour show to a 3 hour show. Obviously, the additional revenue of $150,000 per episode made it an easy decision, and from a financial standpoint, arguably the correct one. Sounds familiar, right? However, note the word arguably here, as ratings have slowly dropped consistently lower and lower since the change. The exact same thing happened eventually to Nitro. One difference to note is that when Nitro originally went to 3 hours, the ratings actually went up, not down. Such was not the case with Raw. But in the past 10 years, things have changed somewhat dramatically for WWE. In the past, pay-per-view buys and house show attendance were the company's largest revenue streams. Today, one of the largest is television rights fees. They have garnered new revenue not only from a longer Raw, but also from new shows, such as Main Event and more. It's definitely more money today, but is the short-term cash boost worth the potential long-term damage of consistently burning out the audience? Time will tell. Perhaps equally important was the fact that football season was about to come to an end. Historically, wrestling ratings always took a major hit in September when the season started, and then in January when Monday Night Football ended, they would return to normal. Often, wrestling bookers would try to swerve people by claiming that they were, quote, turning business around in early January, when in reality, what they wrote had